In this episode, I chair a roundtable about CITV, continuity, and programming. Then, Darren Stratton, podcaster extraordinaire, is our guest in the empty compartment, and we finish things off with the quick fire quiz with Hayley.
This is 90s and Noughties UK, a podcast on UK pop culture of the 90s and 2000s. If you want to contact the show, email 90sandnoughties@gmail.com, tweet us on @90sandnoughtiesUK on Twitter, or check us out on Facebook, 90s and Noughties UK.
So welcome once again to the 90s and Noughties UK podcast with me, Jamie Dyer. And I just wanted to say, before we get into the main content of this week's show, thank you so much to those who have supported the podcast since its first episode nearly 2 months ago, over 2 months ago. I have lost count. Your support is much appreciated. And we have a really packed show today. There is so much in here, so many different features. Later, you'll hear me talking to podcaster extraordinaire Darren Stratton once again about all things 90s and noughties for the empty compartment. Then lastly in the show, you'll hear me once again challenge our round table and now quiz regular Hayley to see if she can beat her previous score in the quick fire quiz. She enjoyed it so much last time, she wanted to see if she can beat it. Stay tuned to find out if she does indeed beat it. But first, this. Not only have we been doing music-related roundtables, I've also tried to do a couple of TV-related things. Certainly things that I believe have got an audience. And boy, is this one where I was really looking forward to this and it did not disappoint. This is the CITV Continuity Roundtable here on the 90s and Noughties UK podcast. This is a 90s and Noughties roundtable. This time we're talking about CITV continuity, which might seem like quite a niche subject, but there's certainly a lot to talk about. CITV first came into prominence in 1983, presented by Matthew Kelly in a rocket ship, which sounds bizarre now, but was the way of the world in 1983. 2 years later, in 85, CBBC, or Children's BBC as it was then known, launched with Philip Schofield at the helm in the broom cupboard. And by the time of the early 90s, things were all change again. Today I'm joined by Robin and Ben, two enthusiasts in this subject matter and much more. I'm sure we shall cover a lot of bases here. When did you both start watching CITV? Let's start with Robin.
I think my earliest sighting of it was probably Mark Granger, who wasn't on there for that long. He was only there for about 6 months, introducing The Real Ghostbusters, which was a very popular program on there. And also remember, I think it was Jan and Scally, Scally the puppet dog, who came afterwards. And I sort of stuck with them. It was after my younger brother was born and I started watching more television. And because CBBC wasn't on as often due to things like Wimbledon, it meant a later start time. I started watching ITV a bit more and it was programmes like Round the Bend and Art Attack and How To, I sort of got excited about. And when Tommy Boy took over after that, I crossed over then. And I mean, we'll go on to like what happened after that pretty soon.
Well, I was born in the Steve Vai era, so for me, really, it was Steve Vai all the way. I first properly started watching CITV about 1996, so much, much later than Robin. And I remember clearly watching SAP. I loved SAP growing up, and Art Attack, and Rosie and Jim and Tots TV and all those kinds of programmes. So, yeah, 1996 for me.
Yeah, the sort of mid-90s were a weird time. That Steve Ride era is interesting because there wasn't any InVision continuity.
No.
Oh, it's very interesting because they actually built models. So it's actually a model town that they built as opposed to like slides that they had in the Tommy Boyda or what followed with like Daniel and Stephen, where they had them in the studio. And but this is very animation based. It was quite clever. A lot of planning went into it.
I mean, this is interesting because around 1996, that was when I started secondary school, and Dawn Airey, who was the head, and I think it was Angela Hughes who took over, they started making it a bit younger. So just as I was getting into my teens, it was starting to aim for people slightly younger than I was. And I can remember like when they had like an animated town, and I think they changed it to like a fantasy kingdom to the period just before they brought back InVision Links.
It's funny how it became InVision again was there was a bloke called Nigel Pickard who took over from Vanessa Chapman. Took over from Zono. And he was like, you know what, we've got to make CITV live. He said, I can't have Leonardo DiCaprio being pre-recorded. We need him live. And that was his reasoning behind it. And so they got the presenters and... That's how it all started.
That's fascinating. No, because he'd come from Flextech. He'd come from Challenge at the time. He just started up Challenge from a family channel. And if you look at all those links from around that time with, I mean, if it's quite weird, it's sort of going full circle with Andy Crane, Pat Sharp.
Yes.
And Ian Collins as well, the radio presenter Ian Collins did stuff for Challenge. It's all shot similar to how they do all the CITV links from Birmingham around that time. So it crosses over. I get that.
Yeah, it's interesting because he also did the TVS programs as well. So he did like Number 73 and Mighty Mouth.
I think he was about as far back as Southern. So he had a very long history in making children's programs, Nigel Pickard.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the late 90s is my first experience of it during those Danielle and Stephen era, where, as you say, it was live and they tried a lot of on screen. Trickery. There was a lot of standing in front of screens and green screen and all things like that. So it was quite exciting, really.
Most notably when we were doing the phone number, because they'd make up a little two-word line to go in between it. And it was, always tried to work out whether that was done live or they'd done it about 10 minutes before. Because like you'd be in those places all at once. It did look very polished.
It's funny because Stephen and Danielle, as you say, even though I grew up with Steve Wright, they were the presenters that I most associated to. Compared to like CBBC, who had Kirsten and Otis, CITV rather had Danielle and Stephen, and you always knew they were going to be there. You know, no matter what, even if one of them was ill, you always knew the other one would be there.
There are only two presenters then, and I mean, I know they did get more about 80 months later, but yes, it was more consistent.
Yeah, I could never quite get into the puppetry of the BBC. It always seemed a bit weird to me.
Well, it's weird because when I've watched back a lot of stuff, both on YouTube and from my own VHSs, I find myself enjoying it slightly more. I think both BBC and ITV, I mean, Kirsten and Otis were pretty consistent. I just didn't think they worked on Saturday mornings, and that, I mean, certainly in their last run, that's why Anton Deck and Cat and SMTV became more popular, because it went all the way round. So when Live and Kicking came back, Anton Deck just completely slaughtered them, and having the backing of a re-established CITV, I think, helped in that respect.
It's funny because you were saying about Saturday morning, CITV tended to struggle. Before SMTV Live, they had Strachinko, MASHED and WOW and Telegantic Megavision. They had all these different shows and they couldn't quite figure out what the viewer wanted. And they had one
there were hardly any viewers to ITV at that time. Not on Saturday mornings. I mean, there's a often repeated story, an often quoted story, when the day after the Canary Wharf attacks, the ITV had its worst Saturday morning lineup, because instead of Saturday Disney on GMTV, you had an extended news program. Then it would cut to the pre-recorded Telegantic Megavision. Then instead of It's Not Just Saturday, which came from Glasgow, so I don't think it was affected by the Canary Wharf bombings, they went to an episode of Sequest DSV instead. So you had, until the ITV chart show started, you had the worst lineup that ITV, I think, had up against Live and Kicking. But then Andy Peters moved from the BBC to LWT to present a Saturday morning music show, which was pointless because it was half an hour long, followed by the hour-long chart show. It was just ridiculous. So, yeah, they did struggle on Saturday mornings for a long time.
And the, I mean, SMTV was extremely exciting. And like you say, kind of won the battle, long-fought battle after then.
Yeah, I think SMTV Live, people could relate to it. I mean, again, CITV was very relatable by 1998. And because Ant and Dec had been doing like PJ and Duncan and Biker Grove and all this stuff. Also, they were on Give Me Five. People could relate to them, and they made it more fun, as opposed to Live and Kicking, which was by now on its last legs. They introduced like Chums and had Wonky Donkey and all these different elements.
Wonky Donkey goes back right to the first show. I don't know if any of you have seen it, but it was a game they played right from the first show. It didn't have a song, but it was an idea that came up from two of the writers. They both worked on BBC Two's The Fast Show and came up with the basic concept for Wonky Donkey. But after a few shows, Deck did get genuinely frustrated with callers not getting the concept that the animal had to rhyme. And he said this to the producer, he said, you can have a go at them. You can get really riled up on air if you want. And that's how it became the best feature of the show, one of the best features of the show.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And even now on clip shows, that's always the thing they go to, is him having a go at a child on air, which now seems completely silly, but back in the day it was hilarious. Something's just come to mind here. I'm just thinking of, because I've seen a few sort of documentaries about periods before the period in which we're talking about. And I know that whenever people used to compare, like Blue Peter, for example, on the BBC to ITV's effort Magpie, they'd say, well, the BBC, they'd imagine their viewer in like a Boy Scout uniform, you know, ready to go and do something, whereas the ITV viewer was out of their school uniform and, you know, a can of Coke in their hand, that sort of thing. Do you think really that using that analogy, do you think that that still kind of applies?
It crossed over years after Magpie finished, yes. So quite possibly.
I think the BBC was always the posher version. It was always very slightly upper class, as it were, compared to ITV, where they were like, you know what, we've got creative freedom, we can do whatever we want to do. And the BBC were more strict, especially the preschool programs like Playdays. You know, that was very rigid and I mean, I loved Playdays, but compared to CITV's output, where you had, you know, like Sap or Rosie and Jim, you know, these characters just create mayhem, you know.
Was it necessarily a preschool program? But I could see, no, it was normally the first show just shown after the preschool show, so I get that connection. But yeah, they were a bit wider and a bit, I mean, you had characters who are deliberately being naughty and getting away with it. Certainly the case of Rosie and Jim or Toss TV.
Yeah, for thinking of Zap, as you mentioned, now I loved that Zap, and obviously it was aimed at children who were deaf or had hearing issues. And as a child, you know, I didn't have such issues, but it didn't matter, did it?
They never made a big deal about it being aimed at deaf and hard of, not, certainly not on screen, maybe in a few listings magazines, but I think that's why it was probably, it wasn't telling them that this is a program aimed at, it was aimed at all people. And yeah. There's a very good interview. I can't remember the web address by heart, but there's a great interview with one of the producers of Zap, Tim Edmonds, explaining in great detail what happened and how it developed and why it sort of came to an end after they started stripping the show on Monday. It wasn't just Zap, it was every show on CITV. They started stripping around 2001 to 2002 time.
Well, believe it or not, I did that interview.
It's, oh, my website. Yeah,
it's my website.
It's a very good interview.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I keep coming back to it a lot. No, so.
Thank you. Yeah, we spoke for about an hour and a half. It was incredible to talk to him.
It is really insightful. Nice,
yeah, really nice. Insightful. I wanted to ask him more, but he said, I've got a dash.
No, it was very well-loving written, actually.
No, thank you very much. Thank you. But it's interesting that era of CITV and the media merchants were, of course, one of the powerhouses of CITV. Mm. So it was very interesting to hear Tim's thoughts and how they made stuff and about like Art Attack going to Disney and, you know, it's, and of course the website is based on Zap. If you haven't visited it, it's zapcomic.com where I talk all things Zap, all the way from the first series all the way to the last. And yeah, some people said it's too much information, but if you enjoy all the little bits and bobs, then I'm sure you'll enjoy that.
No, it's really good.
Sorry, how long? No, it's fine. How long did it take you, Ben, to realise that was Neil Buchanan in the artistic segments?
Oh, a little while. I mean, as a kid, you don't really realise it. But then when you make the links to Art Attack, you're like, yeah, of course it is. You know, you look past the like the hat and the moustache and the fake eyebrows and, you know, and then you realise that, yeah, actually it's Neil Buchanan doing all these stories. And it's interesting because especially from Series 2 onwards, it was very based on Kenny Everett, if you remember that.
Yes.
It's similar sort of stuff. I knew it was Neil Wright from the first show because I can't remember who the presenter was because Tommy Void would have gone by then, but they had, I think, a whole load of different people. I think it was a female presenter, maybe a Home and Away actress, saying right before the first show, if you look very closely, you'll see Neil Buchanan. And, I mean, it was rather weird that first episode, but it was enough to have me hooked for the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, Tricky Dicky was scary, you know. Let's
I found him scary. It was almost... I mean, I found it quite hilarious, but can understand why that had to change and they got Daisy Dare in. It was a bit more like colourful and friendly on the eye.
Absolutely. And it was more, it's more like a comic, you know. It was a comic that came to life. And Daisy Dare was basically Minnie the Minx.
Yeah.
And Tim was telling me, okay, if we can take the essence of Tricky Dicky, because he scares kids, into a character that doesn't scare kids, you know. Then we've got like Minnie the Minx and Daisy Dare, and you know, amazing.
Just transitions really well.
Yeah, and a long-running series on CITV. They had a few of those, didn't they? A couple that spring to mind. Stop me if you've got anything to say about them, but Mike and Angelo is one that ran for a long time, about 10 years.
Maybe a bit too many series, that one, Michelangelo.
Yes, I never quite understood why the change of actor at the beginning from Tyler Butterworth. Perhaps it grew a little bit too big for him or something, I don't know. And the other one I was thinking of was Funhouse, which again ran for 10 years.
Again, that was popular, but it just seemed it barely changed that much during its 10 years on air. I mean, I did watch it, but I didn't know it ran as far as 1999. I would have been 14 by then. I mean, quite old. But then again, that brings it onto something quite nice, because during that period of Stephen and Danielle, you forget there weren't many live shows that went out during the Monday to Friday slot of CITV. And by Friday, a day that had been reserved as Funhouse as the show that started the weekend, you now have the top 10 of everything, which was broadcast live.
My goodness, I absolutely loved that show, and I think it must have been my fascination for lists. I don't know.
No, that's interesting, because it was Vanessa Bailey and Ben something. I can't remember his last name.
I follow him on Twitter. He's a radio presenter now. I keep forgetting his name.
you know who I mean, though. the top 10 of everything.
Ben Jones, that's it, Ben Jones.
Yes, wow, Ben Jones. Yeah, he did a lot of... He also did CITV a little bit for cover.
He did a bit of press. Yeah, there's video on YouTube of him, I think, after Christmas 1998, but early January 99, he did a bit... Him and Vanessa, I think, did presentation for... But yeah, there was the top 10. That was broadcast live because I think of the phone-in polls and Mad For It, which I think started on Wednesdays with Mike McLean and Yolanda, both from Nickelodeon. That lasted quite a while. Then they did a second series, which was shorter and had Danielle co-presenting. And I've actually read Mike McLean's autobiography, and he said that the second series was rubbish compared to the first. But no, it's interesting. I don't care about it.
Yes, I remember both of those shows quite fondly because Mad For It, you saw all the pop acts, of course, at the time. They'd have performances.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously, by the time you got to the early 2000s, the funding really dropped out of that market, didn't it? And it all started to fall away.
Well, live shows were the first to go out of that. So almost immediately, shows like the Top 10 of Everything and Mad For It went... I mean, there was no live shows apart from SMTV, by the way. That's why they started stripping the shows, or also, well, partly also because they got the replacement for Nigel Pickard, another former TVS colleague, Janie Grace. She'd come from Nickelodeon. They strip shows all the time. But when you've got a 22-part American series, you're going to, or multiple 22-part American series, you're going to be spoiled for stuff. Well, in the UK, where you've only got 13 episodes series of shows, you're going to run out of stuff pretty quickly.
It's funny because Janie Grace herself, before she was at Nickelodeon, she was at Meridian. So you probably know who did SAP, Wizardora.
Well, she would have came directly from TVS to Meridian. And that's why they had so many good children's programs.
Yes, yes, it was. Yeah, she was actually headhunted by Meridian. And they said, look, can you be controller of her programs? Yes, commissioned loads of new ones. And then she went to Nickelodeon. And then she came back with the philosophy of, like, okay, I'll do what I did at Nickelodeon, which was strip the programs. So you had, like, SAP, for example, the last series of SAP, unfortunately. It lasted about 2 weeks. It was gone in 2 weeks.
And that was in the week where, I mean, this is really showing my age. That was in the week I'd finished at school, started at college, and this is where I thought, maybe I am too old for this. I mean, I didn't really take notice, but I saw, oh, they're stripping it now. And
yeah,
things were changing a lot. I mean, by then, they got a bigger studio for CITV, increased the number of presenters. So you had, I've got to get his name right because I don't want to mention the actor's name instead, Tom Darville,
yes,
Andrea, and then later you got David and I think Lee and Leah.
I remember all them because they had in 2003 they had a 20th anniversary thing, which is amazing. You know, all these shows,
that was so exciting,
which has suddenly been off. And I've got the whole thing on VHS, so I remember taping it especially that morning because I never normally taped morning CITV, but this particular morning. Yeah. That's like, it's special.
Well, I've put most of the stuff I record, there's not a lot of it, but most of it I put onto my YouTube channel, and there's like a montage of stuff from 98 up to 2006, I think it is. But no, I might still have the 20th anniversary show on VHS, but because I probably got a better stereo copy from YouTube, I haven't transferred that. But the effort put into that was amazing. Just unfortunate that a couple of weeks after that, Janie Grace was sacked after Nigel Pickard arrived. Now as head of ITV, the controller. I can't remember the exact position, but he'd taken over from, I think, David Liddleman.
Yes, I think he did. I think you're right. But I didn't know she was sacked.
Well, she left in rather, I don't know if she was sacked, but she hadn't spoken very positively about, she was worried about the two big ITV companies, Carlton and Granada, investing in children's programs, and said at a Voice of the Listener and Viewer conference that she didn't think they believed in it at all.
And I don't think they did. I think you're right. I mean, the quality of kids' TV, especially CITV, dipped towards around 2003, just after that anniversary, after they went, look at all the amazing shows we've done. And it just, you know, it was so weird.
It was a very tough time. I mean, CBBC had just started their digital territory. I was given the overall presentation of that a big kick up the bum. That was gradually starting to improve. It became more consistent, whereas ITV, they were just starting to give up. And it was a bit of a shame because it was around the time, I think it was Michael Underwood and Leah Charles. And Michael was probably actually my favourite presenter from around this time because he'd had the experience of the BBC, had a really great sense of humour whenever anything went wrong. I mean, he had a very big laugh and was quite good at doing characters as well, though there was one he did of the late Steve Irwin where it had a really rubbish Australian accent. Crocodile Mike, that's it, because they used to show the Crocodile Hunter Diaries after. It was in the period when they couldn't find a replacement for Home and Away. They tried bringing back Crossroads. That didn't work. They moved a load of game shows to a daytime slot, and that didn't work either. It wasn't until, I think, Paul O'Grady came along that it started to work, but then he went off to Channel 4. But no, there was a bit of a... I mean, you saw trails for Crossroads within CITV around this time, an attempt to get people to watch it, and... That's how desperate it was.
Imagine if they did that for Home and White. Like, if they did that during the Steve Lydar. Imagine.
That would have been yeah. Fun. I mean, the big thing is, I mean, you wonder how they dealt with incoming news events around that time. And I can actually remember, it was just after the Steve Ride era began on CITV. There was this story about, I think it was the Maastricht treaty, and John Major had been put into a vote of, there was a confidence vote in John Major, and they cut to, I think, a Meridian announcer in our region saying that it would continue after an ITV update on the vote of political confidence. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it did feel a bit weird.
Oh, that's amazing. I mean, I remember one of the things I do remember faintly about CITV is that sometimes it used to break down, especially during Steve Lydar. They used to have these little robots, and the robots would come up on screen and they'd try and fix CITV. And they had...
I do remember that little graphic, yeah.
And they had the same graphic for about 5 years with Steve Lydar.
Yeah.
And it never changed. They never changed. They changed everything else, but not that little graphic.
But not that standby. But no, bringing it back to around 2003, I mean, it's weird. They started off with that big anniversary. By the end of the year, it looked as if they wouldn't be any CITV, or at least any live presentation, because in September they had a big revamp. They didn't change the logo completely, but they flattened it, had a new like jingle, which was a four-note sonic, and you thought they got rid of the studio, because it was, I think, an Aliens week when it was first introduced as special to mark the new series of My Parents Are Aliens. And when there was a new studio, it was either only a single presenter, so either Michael or Leah. And it was a set that looked as if it was made out of polystyrene with a big hologram in it. And it lacked the sort of enthusiasm and the ad-libbed manner that had been there before. And it was only going to get worse because around that time they'd announced that SMTV was going to be finishing that Christmas and a new show, which sort of brings it all back to Nigel Pickard, because he had a hand in the founding of the foundation who produced it. Ministry of Mayhem started, hosted by two ex-CITV presenters, Michael Underwood and Stephen Mulhern, and poaching Holly Willoughby from CBBC. So they had to start all over again after Christmas.
Yeah, Jamie, do you remember that?
Well, I remember Ministry of Mayhem. It was sort of at the end of my sort of watching, because I became almost tired of it around 2003, around that time, just after the anniversary. It's like, oh, wait a minute, we've looked back at what's already happened, and that's kind of my time. You know, really, my peak time was somewhere between 97 and 03. After that, once the funding drew out and it became more American programming, and really the only program I was watching was My Parents Are Aliens. Which seemed to run for ages.
Yeah, it lasted about 7 years, although mainly think it should have finished in 2005 with, because the family they'd adopted left, then they brought a whole new one in, and that only lasted one series, but that was mainly down to ITV shutting down the Granada kids in the it was based in Leeds because I think it was a Yorkshire program for the first series. It was credited to Yorkshire for the first series.
Yeah, and I think that's the key. You've touched upon something, is that all the great CITV shows of the past were all part of regions. And by the early 2000s, the regions are starting to close in. And now it's kind of, it's just one company now.
Yeah, well, you only have to watch the, I don't know if like there's any of it be uploaded yet. I mean, I've got a video that I downloaded years ago of the last ever Ministry of Mayhem, although it changed to Holly and Stephen's Saturday Showdown. And at the end, it was credited as a foundation production for ITV, because it's all become ITV. Initially, it was a co-production with Carlton and the Foundation, but then when ITV changed its logo, the merger, they started crediting it, all Carlton programs became Granada, and then when it had another rebrand, it all became ITV.
That's interesting, because that's what happened with City as well towards the end. I mean, I used to love City and Co., if you remember that, with Matthew Corbett.
That was when Granada made it. Yes, I did like that version of it.
And then they made City Heights, which is okay. Richard Goodell took over in the honour, who used to do CITV continuity as well. And then it went, then what happened, Granada Kids became part of the Foundation, I think. Don't quote me on that. But then it kind of became, like you say, the regions closed in. And, you know, that's what acts that, and My Parents Are Aliens, and Art Attack. You know, Art Attack was one of the last to go.
So. Yeah, well, How To went around at the same time. That was made by Scottish, but so was Art Attack. Well, I think we're presenting it. Scottish presented it. The Media Merchants made it, but Scottish presented it, and it was still made in Maidstone.
And then they just put an axe to it. They just went, it's funny, as soon as the CITV channel launched, they went, like, we're going to stop in-house production. That's it.
It was bad. They wanted to launch a channel in around 2001 before the BBC started, but that fell apart. Then I've read that they tried to, I think, do a figure double, a deal with Nickelodeon with the ridiculous name INK Inc., I think ITV Nickelodeon, because they're showing a lot of their shows like SpongeBob, the spin-off of the Rugrats All Grows Up. They started showing the Rugrats after they'd been on the BBC for 11 years. And I mean, that didn't seem to work. And then when the channel launched, by the time the CITV channel launched, I was at university. So I would be barely like aware of like what was going on at all. And it's, and I mean, when I did see it, whenever I went back to where I lived in Canterbury during the holidays, I thought, this isn't looking good at all. I think one of the last things I taped from it was, I mean, the very end of, I think, I can't remember what it was, but they started in, when, as soon as they launched the channel, they wanted to do everything they could to get it off ITV proper, so ITV One proper as it was. So they started moving the end time. It finished at, when it finished at 10 past five, it now finished at 4:30. And they started putting repeats of Airline and Rising Damp on around that time. And then to try and take on Channel 4 with their success of Noel Edmonds and Deal or No Deal, they brought back The Price is Right with Joe Pasquale. And it was even worse. I mean, it makes me laugh that they brought The Price is Right back because it'd been successful in Ant and Dec's Game Show Marathon. And then they did another series of Game Show Marathon with Vernon Kay, which also opened with The Price is Right about a year later, just months after the Joe Pasquale one had been axed. And then they took it off Saturday mornings. They took CITV off Saturday mornings and then I think reduced it to, I think it was just for GMTV hours. And it was a rather disappointing. I mean, it's still there now, but you wouldn't, not with the same heart that it had when we grew up watching it.
No, I don't think it ever will come back in that capacity. And I look down the channel now at the dedicated CITV channel, and it just seems to be half repeats, half American import. Even My Parents Are Aliens appears to have been taken off its throne. It was on there for years.
It's over 15 years. The last episodes are only 15 years old now. It was 21 as a whole since it started. That's worrying. That's frightening.
That is frightening. It seems so recent.
Yeah.
It's funny because CITV as a whole, it was designed to evolve, but I think the way it evolved didn't, you know, part of it didn't work towards the end, especially.
It wanted to go back. I was reading an article from The Guardian earlier, which said that about the launch of the channel, we want to bring it back to how it was when Dawn Airey was running it, with an element of mad, brash and wacky. I think mad was the buzzword that was listed in that article. And it sort of did look a bit like that, but worse.
I tell you, the only redeeming feature was the old school weekend. 2013.
Yeah, 2013. Yes.
I have to say, I watched the whole thing. I absolutely loved it. And I did read somewhere that they probably spent something like half a year's budget on just that one weekend. there was a lot of stuff that was in there. Things that probably hadn't been seen on that channel for a long time.
Well, it hadn't been shown since they were first shown, quite possibly.
Yeah, and, you know, I hope in a couple of years' time they go to do the same thing, but we'll just have to wait and see. What do you think during the sort of golden period of CITV, what do you think was the definitive show, like the one show that you just had to watch?
Mine would probably be SMTV, because that's, I think, the one that actually made the effort to, because I was a bit old for most of the stuff that went out during the day, but... Not that they were some, I did like some of the live shows, as mentioned, like the top 10 of everything. But yeah, SMTV would probably define it mind.
Okay, for me, I guess it'd have to be SAP. I mean, I just love that show. I still love it now. It's just a comic coming to life. It's so creative and so funny. And, you know, there's been nothing like that on TV since. And, you know, it's incredible. You know, it's a comic coming to life. It was... And it had no spoken words, saying only text on the stream, and people went, you know, all these silly voices. And
Neil did all the voices. Well, Sophie Aldridge did the later series, but it's a testament to both of them for making that work.
Absolutely. And but there's so many to choose from. I mean, I've got loads of them running through my head. I mean, even the American cartoon series to show, like Animaniacs and Tiny Toons, they were incredible.
I think Pokemon was the most popular around the Danielle and Steven period.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And Cardcaptors. Yeah, that was...
Yeah,
that was
my younger brother liked them. Yeah. I suppose you could say My Parents Are Aliens was probably another of the most defining shows that wasn't live or magazine, but was a sitcom that was, you forget how popular that was. And when it was announced Granada Kids were shutting down, Tony Gardner, I remember Tony Gardner, I think, appearing on Radio 4PM that evening, talking to Eddie Mair about how they were getting rid of the show and ITV didn't want to invest in child audiences. That's how big a story it was.
Yeah, I bet Tony Gardner wasn't happy.
No.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, not every show was a My Parents Are Aliens. One that's just sprung to mind, there's a couple that spring to mind. One of them was, what was it called? Like Adam's Family Tree or something.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah, I remember that being trailed in a Christmas preview of new shows, and I thought, you came up with the title before you thought of the show.
Yeah, and the other one that springs to mind, it was called something like Whizbee. Or something like that. It was this weird, like ET-like creature, but with just the head.
And name escapes me. Not WYSIWYG, because
no, it's something along those lines, isn't it?
There was a WYSIWYG.
Yeah, but there was another series in the early 90s called WYSIWYG that had Nick Wilton, who was, I think, on number 73. That was like in the Tommy Boyd era, and it only lasted one series, so. Completely different from that weird puppet.
Yeah, that was strange. It was strange. Yeah, I think there are a lot of series where they came up with the name first. I mean, Poltergeists. I mean, that was weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, I remember, again, it's because I would have been later. I think I'd probably be about 14 or 15 when that. So, again... As pointed out, CITV were completely refusing to acknowledge that teenagers watched for most of their adverts. I mean, that's when why Nightmare got cancelled around the mid-90s, because Vanessa Chapman wasn't a fan.
Yeah, it's funny because I think a lot of programs, depending on who was controller, were axed. And it's funny because when SAP was going to be axed and Bernard Watch around the same year, They were like, you know what, we'll put it to a public vote because we haven't got the budget. So the budget halved. That's why they couldn't launch the CITV channel. And they were like, you know what, we'll do a viewer's choice. And the one who gets the least amount will be axed. So in early 2002, I remember this faintly, they had a phone-in where you could choose your favourite programme. So, like, change the schedule so you could watch, like, SAP or Art Attack, Brilliant Creatures or Fingertips, you know. And they were like, okay, so we've collected all the data and, you know, people aren't watching SAP and Burner's Watch, let's just get rid of that. It was kind of eeny, meeny, miny, moe. For the schedules, so it's a shame. It is a shame.
Yeah, and they did bring back Bernard's Watch again in 2004, but with a different lead actor. And I think that they just shortened it to just Bernard then. But I mean, it is rather sad to see how it all came to an end.
Bernard's Watch was great.
Yeah, I loved that show absolutely, and the remake just didn't. It didn't match up to it. No. It didn't have that same sense of wonder and innocence.
You forget that it was based from an EBU anthology series, which they used to show in the mid-90s of different stories from different countries, which I think they'd adapt into English. Well, they'd have an English narrator, and Bernard's Watch was one of them. And then they turned that into a series. It became, well, it was a lot better. The series was better than the EBU version. But, so, yeah.
I've never saw the EBU version.
They used to show them in the slot that Zap was in during the summer until they started repeating Zap quite a lot because, like it said in your interview, they wanted more of it. They got all the spin-offs and yes, the summer specials, the Christmas annuals and all that.
Yeah, well, that seems like a great place to stop there because we could go on talking about this for hours, I'm sure. There is just so much to cover, and certainly I love that in the last 5 minutes we've uncovered that there was a lot more to CITV than just Zap, Art Attack, How To, those, there were all these little weird shows that kind of popped up for a few weeks and then disappeared. Thank you, Robin and Ben, for joining me today, and hopefully
thanks
we
for
can
letting us on.
No worries, and hopefully we can do this again at another time.
Yeah,
no, thank you very much.
And once again, thank you very much to the participants of the CITV Continuity Roundtable. And don't worry, dear listener, we will be going back to that subject at a later stage. But first, it's time for that part of the program called The Empty Compartment. Darren, what's your favourite memory of CITV?
Gosh, got so many of them. I just can't think of just one off the top of my head.
Ah, well, there we go. Not much of a viewer back in the day.
Although I did have a soft spot for Tots TV.
Well, there we go. I think we all loved Tots TV. Now, onwards to The Empty Compartment. And now it's time for another episode, if you will, within the 90s and Noughties podcast of The Empty Compartment. Three questions, one guest. The more random, the better. Is that for the questions or the guest? I will let you decide that. And remember, all of this is 90s and Noughties related, so it's all within the subject of the podcast. Darren Stratton, podcast extraordinaire, thank you very much for joining us once again. And normally, I always say this, but I never actually mean it. Normally, and we've only done a few of these, and I've always done the same thing, so not normally at all. Tell us your question, Darren.
Now, that's what I call music. Volume 17 or 74?
Oh, now, give me a rundown of what's on 17.
From 1990. So, 3 a.m. Eternals on that one.
Right.
That's about all I know.
Well, I mean, just based off that one song, yeah, I'm going for that because 74 has got "Fight for This Love" by Cheryl Cole on it, hasn't it?
Yeah. But you're probably thinking to yourself that Darren's up to his tricks again. I've gone both ends of the scale.
Yeah. That is pretty much both ends of the scale, like last time with the Windows question from a couple of editions ago. Now, I would say now 17, simply because it is it's 1990, and I think music was a little bit better than it was in 2009. You know, when 74 covers it. Yeah, I mean, which one would you choose?
I'm probably in the same boat as you.
Yeah, I mean, we should say, for our international listeners, we're talking about the UK version of Now That's What I Call Music, because there are other versions around the world where 17 could be something a lot more recent.
Yeah, I mean, Israel are only on 24 or 25, and...
Yeah, so I've got the track listing here. We've got Blue Savannah by Erasure, Better World by The Rebel MC, Opposites Attract, Paula Abdul, Dub Be Good To Me, Beats International. Yeah, definitely 17. That's one of my favourite songs of all time. UB40, Kingston Town, Strawberry Fields Forever by Candy Flip, I Don't Want To Lose You by Tina Turner, I Wish It Would Rain Down, Phil Collins, Step On by Happy Mondays. Oh yeah, I mean, this is a slice. This is a slice of 1990, isn't it?
Yeah. The first thing that came to my mind when you mentioned Step On was Sean Ryder then released an autobiography called Twisting My Melon.
Yeah, I mean, that's the...
There's a Step On.
That is the phrase that everybody remembers from that. Yeah, even just from those very few tracks. I mean, I can't remember what's on 74, and that's probably because I was starting to turn off of modern music at that point. So my personal point of view is, yeah, 17... all the way. And it just so happens, I mean, I listen to 19 a lot. I've got that somewhere. And that's from 1991, I think, from about a year later, because they release two a year, don't they?
Yeah, so it was there would have been 17 and 18 from that, and then you got 19 and 20 from 1991. And then we did three a year after that.
I mean, that's fantastic, isn't it?
America's on four at the moment.
Yeah, I love those Now albums. Certainly back in the day, they were extremely good and a very good indicator of the national taste at that particular moment in time. Well, there we go. That is the first question here on the Empty Compartment. Thank you very much, Darren, for asking. Crash Bandicoot or Spyro the Dragon? Which one was better?
Crash Bandicoot.
Really?
Yeah, it was a bit easier. I found Crash Bandicoot was easier to play. There was a particular section of a level that I remember where you went up and you saw a whole pile of extra lives. There was about 40 of them in the end, in that one bonus section alone.
Yeah, the bonus sections were extremely fun. Do you, like me, do you find it difficult when it's like open world and you're just like running around and you don't know where it is you're going?
Yeah.
Yeah. That is what draws me towards Crash, because it's a linear thing. It's much easier. I mean, actually, to say that Crash Bandicoot, the game, is easy is ridiculous, because it gets extremely hard a lot further on. But just...
You've got that section of 40 lives.
Yeah. I mean, that's why they give you loads of lives, because you keep losing them through dying, through trying over and over again. And it's funny, I said Crash because I liked the linearness of it, yeah. That it's much closer to those Mario and Sonic type games.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're definitely saying Crash Bandicoot.
Definitely.
Excellent. Well... Where are we? So let's see. So we're on to the third question here on the Empty Compartment, and it's a listener-based question. Thank you very much to Linda for getting in contact with us and submitting this question. Now, obviously, this wasn't aimed at Darren in particular. It's not really aimed at me in particular. It's just something that they were interested in. It could be random. You could know about it. You might not. So let's see. So the question that they ask is, did Sonic the Hedgehog go downhill after Sonic Adventure?
I really can't say.
No, because I prefer those early 2D ones.
Yeah, we're talking 1991.
Yeah.
I really can't say, because I've never played any... I've not really played that many Sonic games past Sonic Adventure, so I can't say.
No, but those early ones are great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever play the Master System version that was different to the Mega Drive version?
I'll tell you something. The Game Gear version and the Master Edition of Sonic 1, Master System that was, you had extra points depending on how well you did in the game. And I ended up once with 39 lives. So you ended up with 5,000 points for each one. I ended up racking up a score just under 1.3 million.
I mean, I love that version of the game. I think it's better than the Mega Drive version.
Did you know that in the Sonic 1 and 2, in the Game Gear version, if you completed a level in under 20 seconds, you had a time bonus of 300,000 points?
Surely... Wait, you say in under 20 seconds?
Yeah.
I don't think even the... Surely the speed of the Master System, unless you were like using some kind of emulator and speeding it up, surely the Master System wouldn't allow you to go that fast.
Well, there were some people like myself on one occasion when I did Sonic Mods, did a park code which stopped the clock at zero.
Surely, though, without all that, it's impossible to do that
in under 20 seconds.
Yeah.
But I saw someone on YouTube did that once.
No, I don't know. You'll have to send me the video, because something about that sounds fishy. Something about that sounds weird, because that the machine didn't move fast enough. Whenever you went fast, it had this sort of weird slowdown thing.
Yeah, it was that was it. It was someone called Amy Rose Longplays completed Sky Chase Sonic 2 and Sonic 1 in 18 seconds.
Wow.
And had a time bonus of 300,000.
In answer to the listener's question, Darren can't personally answer it because he hasn't played anything past Sonic Adventure, but I would say, as someone who has, yeah, definitely those early ones are better. I don't think it has really been bettered since then, although I did like the new Sonic Mania. I thought that was extremely good, because it was more of a throwback to that other stuff from early on. And I think, unlike Mario, Sonic had struggled in the 3D sphere, but only because maybe Sega haven't always known what to do with the character. Well, there we are. That is the last question in this edition of The Empty Compartment. Thank you once again, Darren, for joining us today.
Pleasure.
So it's another edition of the Quickfire Quiz for the 90s and Noughties UK podcast. And I'm joined again by the first person to take part in our quiz. Will she better her previous score of 9? Stay tuned to find out. Welcome, Hayley.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, no, that's quite all right. She was very adamant. She wanted to come back because she was like, I need to do better, because she slipped over the answer to one of the questions, which was, who was the lead singer of Pulp? And you couldn't think of the name Jarvis Cocker. And you said you kept getting it confused. You had Cocker in your head, but not Jarvis.
Yeah, I was thinking of Joe Cocker, the fact that there's two, and I was just like, oh, what is it?
Yeah, and there's about a 30-year difference there, I think.
Yeah, I don't know why I have Joe Cocker in my head.
Well, I mean, he's also a great singer. So, yeah, for those who haven't listened before, this is 90 seconds to answer pop-related questions of the 90s and noughties, not pop culture, just simply pop music, and mainly UK based. So we'll just set our timer, and we'll say, Hayley, you have 90 seconds starting from now. Which girl group were Two Bootalicious?
Oh, Destiny's Child.
Correct. Something Good was an early 90s hit for Utah. What?
No, don't know. I can't think of it.
Okay. Who presented CD UK alongside Antedeck?
Cat Deely.
Correct. Which artist had hits with Arms Around the World and Naked?
Louise.
Correct. Who released her third studio album, Music Box, in 1993?
I'm going to take a guess, and it's not. I'm going to say Gabrielle, but no, I'll have to pass that one.
No, that's incorrect. What was Brian McFadden's first solo single called?
Pass, can't think of it, sorry.
Okay, that's incorrect. So, which EastEnders actress released the song I'm Over You in 2000?
Pass.
Okay. Which famous US actor formed the title of the debut single from Gorillaz?
Pass.
Okay. Complete the title of the...
Sorry, I just remembered that one. Clint Eastwood.
Okay, I'll give you that one. Complete the title of this S Club 7 single. Don't... Don't what?
Don't Stop Moving.
Okay. Which amphibian artist hit the top of the charts with
Crazy Frog?
That's correct. And we're out of time there. So let's check through your answers, shall we? Let's check through your answers. Have you done better than 9 from previously? So, okay, which girl group were Too Bootylicious? You were correct with Destiny's Child. Something Good was an early 90s hit for Utah Saints.
Couldn't think of that one.
Yeah, that's early 90s, some early 90s trivia there. Who presented CD UK alongside Antedeck? That is obviously Cat Deely. You got that correct. Which artist had hits with Arms Around the World and Naked? Louise. Who released her third studio album, Music Box, in 1993? You said Gabrielle. The answer was Mariah Carey.
Oh.
What was Brian McFadden's first solo single called? It was called Real to Me. Which EastEnders actress released the song I'm Over You in 2000? Martine McCutcheon.
Oh.
And I gave you it, even though you came to it quite late, but that's fine. Which famous US actor formed the title of the debut single from Gorillaz? Clint Eastwood. Complete the title of this S Club single, Don't Stop. You said Don't Stop Moving. That is correct. And, of course, the amphibian that hit the charts with Axel F, that was Crazy Frog. So that gives you a score of 6. You appear to have that thing where you got one answer wrong and then your mind just goes blank, doesn't it?
I know. It's especially like going back to the Gorillaz, because I even bought that single. I just couldn't think of it. I was like, oh, yeah. I was just...
I know, it's such a pain, and I think the questions were a tiny little bit harder than last time.
Yeah, slightly. Yeah, you definitely made them a bit harder this time.
Oh well, that's good. I should have made them easy, shouldn't I? Beat that 9 score. It's all right.
You know that's gonna get to me now.
Yeah, you could. That's all right. You can come back at another time, and if anybody
I'll be on it all the time. Don't encourage me.
Yeah, we're just we'll have to rename it beat Haley or something. If anyone is interested. And if anyone has a better title, by the way, than Beat Haley, that's just something that's on the top of my head. Is there a better title?
I was going to say, if anyone's willing to take me on.
Yeah, challenge challenge Haley. That's a good title, isn't it? Challenge Haley. Like challenge Ant. So if anyone is interested in coming on and taking part in the quickfire quiz, or as it might soon be known, Challenge Haley, then please do get in contact with the podcast. And thank you very much, Haley, for joining in today.
Thanks again for having me. It was great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 90s and Noughties UK, a podcast on UK pop culture of the 90s and 2000s. Please remember to rate, comment, and subscribe on your favourite podcast provider. If you want to contact the show, email 90sandnoughties@gmail.com, tweet us on @90sandnoughtiesUK on Twitter, or check us out on Facebook, 90s and Noughties UK.